Thank you very much. Just a small correction to Emma's introduction. Not quite 30 years. I'm privileged to say that it's been 16 years that I was the neighbour of Dr. Ling's, and I'd known him for a couple of years, 3 years before that. So that is, I suppose, the familial basis upon which I allowed myself the implicit presumption of speaking about him to you tonight. I just would like first to thank Emma for organizing these lectures with Stephen Overy and everybody at the Temenos Academy. And also to thank, in particular, two people who are here tonight who have come all the way from San Francisco, in fact, Richard and Farah Meraz. And this is the second time they've come to a lecture on Dr. Ling's, and having come all the way from San Francisco. This shows something of the extraordinary magnetism that Dr. Ling's continues to exert after his passing away. Also, very grateful to two other neighbors of Dr. Ling's who have come. The other side of Dr. Ling's are present with us today, the Kittels, and it's a very great pleasure to welcome them warmly here tonight. I'm also very grateful that someone who I regard as a model for all disciples has been able to come to join us from Egypt, Justin Majdoub and his mother, who I do consider to be models of discipleship, because much quicker than the rest of us, they recognized the dazzling evidence of Dr. Ling's sanctity, which is the subject of my talk. I really should begin the talk with an alternative self-portrait to the one that I would encourage all of you to read in his collected poems, where he describes himself so beautifully in relation to his love for different religious traditions. It's the one very telling autobiographical poem, as it were, which takes us through a series of religions. And it's all about the modes in which God has spoken to man, the contact between heaven and earth. And he describes poetically and beautifully about Krishna and his flute. He describes so touchingly the looks that were exchanged between the Blessed Virgin and Jesus at the marriage of Cana, and about the wine that was brought forth from water. He talks about the, rather wistfully at this point, he says, "My hand was not free to give itself in fealty to the Arab prophet beneath the tree." And he's referring here to the prototype of the initiation into the spiritual mysteries of the religion. That is the taking of the oath of allegiance, the bay'ah, beneath the tree. This is a second oath subsequent to the one where you become a Muslim. It's where the Prophet, quite unexpectedly, alayhi salatu wasalam, took an oath from his closest companions at Hudaybiyah, and at this point they were not sure what this second oath meant. Subsequent generations were able to understand that this second oath is the oath of initiation into the esoteric, the inner aspects of the tradition. And this is what we're going to be speaking about tonight to a large extent in relation to Martin Ling's. In this self-portrait, however, before we go on, we should note that it's as if he's making a complaint that he was not there to listen to Krishna's flute. He was not there to participate in this wonderful wedding feast at Cana. He wasn't there to give his hand to the prophets in initiation. But at the very end of the poem, we realize that this was all a foil for the expression of his tremendous gratitude for actually having witnessed all of these wonderful events of revelation. Because he finishes the poem by saying, "No more I say would it had been, for I have seen what I have seen, and I have heard what I have heard. So if to tears ye see me stirred, presume not that they spring from woe. In thankful wonderment they flow. Praise be to him, the Lord, the King, who gives beyond all reckoning. So at the end of the poem, we're struck by the power of this man's ability to actually say, I have seen all of these things and I have heard all of these revelations. Don't think that if you see me crying, I'm crying in the mode of a nostalgic traditionalist who was written down too late in the Book of Fate, as he puts it in another part of the poem. Instead, he's saying that a true traditionalist is actually a perennialist, is actually a son of the moment, Ibn al-Waqt in Sufism, a fundamental principle to be the son of the moment, which means that at any moment you have available and accessible to you all of these treasures of revelation which give rise to sanctification. It's a concrete possibility that he had realized and which he made accessible to all of those amongst us who were privileged to come within the sphere of his radiance and his guidance. Now, I'm going to return to this poem because we also have, at the very end of my talk, inshallah, we also have a very thinly veiled reference to the Blessed Virgin, quite apart from what he said in the earlier part of the poem. Those last few words will be recognized by those of you who know the Quran well as being a reference to the words that the Blessed Virgin spoke in the Quran after her food was provided for her miraculously from heaven. And the person who was looking after her in the temple, Zacharias, found food with her, and he said to her, where did you get this from? And she said, إِنَّهُ مِنْ عِنْدِ اللَّهِ إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَرْزُقُ مَنْ يَشَاءُ بِغَيْرَ حِسَابٍ. Truly this has come from God. God indeed gives sustenance to whom he will, beyond all reckoning. So in the last line of the poem, we have a reference, a veiled reference to that response of the Blessed Virgin to this question. And we'll come to that at the end of the talk. But right now, I want to give you another self-portrait, as it were, or a portrait of his true self. And that is by recommending to all of you to read chapter 6 of The Stations of Wisdom by Fritjof Schuon. The Stations of Wisdom are expressed throughout that book, but in this chapter, number 6, you have one of the most succinct and revealing expositions of an aspect of Fritjof Schuon's perspective, which is what you might call methodical. It's the spiritual, practical aspect. 6 stations of wisdom that are there to be assimilated, but also realized. Assimilated by the mind, but realized by the heart. And in those 6 stations of wisdom, you will find, beautifully expressed, the soul of Martin Lings himself. What are these 6 stations? Very briefly, there are so many ways in which the human and the divine are brought into harmonious confrontation. Taking the word confrontation literally, face to face. How is the human brought into harmonious confrontation, brought face to face with God? First, the divine purity elicits from the human being the quality of abstention, renunciation. Second, divine power elicits from the human being the quality of affirmation, of accomplishment. Third, the divine peace, the divine beauty, elicits from the human being the quality of contentment. Fourth, the divine mercy elicits from the human being the quality of trust. Fifth, the divine truth, which elicits from the human being the quality of discernment. And finally, 6th, the station, the divine face, the divine reality of selfhood, which elicits from the human being the quality of concentration or union. You can read the rest of that chapter to see how this is fleshed out, and if you read the chapter associated with the virtues in the way, in esotericism as principle and as way, of Fridtjof Schuon, you'll see how all of these virtues are beautifully described in a way that shows them to be reflections of divine qualities. And that, as I say, is one of the most powerful and penetrating ways of entering into the reality of the soul of Martin Lings, to look at the way in which his master, Fridtjof Schuon, Sheikh Isa Nur ad-Din, how his teachings were embodied in Martin Lings, in Sheikh Abu Bakr Siraj ad-Din, radiallahu anhuma wa anna bihima. Because his life, Martin Lings' life, was one long life of unwavering fidelity, unflinching loyalty to his teacher, his master, Fridtjof Schuon. He makes this absolutely clear in chapter 1 of his last book, which was called A Return to the Spirit. Very aptly named, because he put the finishing touches to that book very shortly before he passed away. So this was really his return to the Spirit. And in that, in chapter 1, he asks, how did I come to put first things first? And in that chapter we read how, as a Catholic, Martin Lings had prayed fervently to the Blessed Virgin for a guide. He'd come across the writings of Genon, the precursor, the forerunner to Fridtjof Schuon. And it was through Genon's writings that he was brought into an understanding of the concepts of tradition, of orthodoxy, and of esotericism, the inner path. And I remember, and I think as I look around, at least 10 people here were with me at a church in Notting Hill Gate when Dr. Lings spoke about the first time he read the books of Genon. And he said, it was as if I was struck by lightning. And at that very moment, as if by cosmic stage management, lightning flashed from above, and it entered into the church in a very strange way. It was one of those, it was a modern church, and for once something modern actually worked to our benefit, because this modern church had a glass roof, and so this lightning came right through the roof, and the whole of the church was illuminated by this. As soon as he had said the words, it was as if I was struck by lightning, and then the lightning came. So afterwards I said to him, did you notice that, Sayyidina Sheikh, at the time when you said what you said, that the whole church was filled by lightning? He said, well, I was aware of something. That was typical of him, to marginalize anything that is sensational, phenomenal, all of which are, in fact, worldly things, because he was rooted in certainty of metaphysical principles. That was the miracle for him. That was the miracle to which he gave himself from the beginning to the end of his life. In the light of that, you have what he would always insist upon, you have a sense of proportions. Everything, every problem that you're confronted with can be resolved if you have the right sense of proportions. He said this again and again and again. And that means never being in any way deflected from your vision of the certainty of God's beatitude, of the divine love, of the divine compassion, of the divine reality, from any worldly contingency whatsoever. And that's a fundamental facet of the sanctity that I'll be speaking about, as we'll see at the very end of the talk, inshallah. So, in this chapter, number one, he says he prayed fervently as a Catholic to the Blessed Virgin, not just ora pro nobis, pray for us, but specifically pray that I be guided to a spiritual master. He says, my supplication was always one and the same, that I should find a truly great spiritual master who would take me as his disciple, initiate me into the way, and guide me to its end. And the more he prayed, the more he was led to this small group of Sufis in Switzerland, until finally he met Fridtjof Schuon, who was already Sheikh Isa Nur ad-Din in 1937. And he says, and so I met the answer to my highly demanding prayer. Despite his years, he was only 30, this is referring to Fridtjof Schuon, his appearance corresponded perfectly to all that I had prayed for. But that did not increase my certitude that he was indeed the answer to my prayer, for I was already by the grace of heaven, as certain as I could be. Nor has that certitude ever wavered during the 66 wonderful years that I have been privileged to be his disciple. He writes this, as I say, in the very last book of his life, at which time he had been the disciple of Sheikh Isa for this long period of 66 years. And that discipleship flowed over, of course, after Sheikh Isa passed away. It didn't stop at that point. Even when he accepted himself the title of Sheikh, Sheikh Abu Bakr Siraj ad-Din, he never for a moment let us forget that he was first and foremost the disciple of Sheikh Isa. And I'll come to this extraordinary humility that the man had, despite his own greatness, in a moment. But first I just want to talk about him as Abu Bakr Siddiq. He was given the name Abu Bakr immediately by Fridtjof Schuon, Sheikh Isa. And as most of you know, I think Abu Bakr is the name of the first caliph of Islam. And his epithet was As-Siddiq, the one who speaks the truth, the one who is sincere, the confirmer of truth. And that really sums up the character and the soul of Dr. Lings. Because he was one who was utterly sincere in the pursuit of the truth, which he seized upon with such alacrity, recognized instantly, and made it his life's work to assimilate in totality. And Fridtjof Schuon has referred to the spiritual path as being the path from natural hypocrisy. We're all in a state of natural hypocrisy at the beginning. We know various things, we intend to do various things, but our will is weak, and we are to some extent hypocritical in the affirmation of those beliefs. We don't make enough effort to substantiate the sincerity of our intention to realize certain truths, realize certain virtues. So Schuon has defined the spiritual path very succinctly as being the path from natural hypocrisy to spiritual sincerity. And Martin Lings is one who, one could say, made that journey. He did come to the end of that path. He arrived at Siddiq, which is the root of this, at the root of this word, Siddiq, the one who confirms the truth when he sees it. Now, this word is also, it can be translated as saint. Siddiq can also be translated simply as saint, as Dr. Lings himself did in his translation of a verse which he loved to recite. And these are from, this translation is from his book on the Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. He said that the last words that the Prophet recited before he died were the following: with the supreme communion in paradise. He was heard to murmur these words, then citing the Quran, he said, with those upon whom God hath showered his favor, the prophets and the saints and the martyrs and the righteous, most excellent for communion are they. That's chapter 4, verse 69. It's a very powerful verse. It's talking about those who God has graced. Alladhina an'amta alayhim. We say this in the Fatiha. When we pray the basic canonical prayer, we're asking God to guide us upon the straight path, the path of those whom thou hast graced. So in this verse, those people are described. Who are the ones who have been graced by God? Alladhina an'ama Allahu alayhim minan nabiyyin was-siddiqin wash-shuhada was-salihin wa hasuna ulaika rafiqa. That's the Arabic of the words I've just read for you in English. The prophets, the saints, the martyrs, and the righteous. Most excellent for communion are they. It's very interesting that most English translators, most people who translate the Quran from Arabic to English, translate Siddiqun as being the sincere or the truthful ones. And they shy away from what Martin Lings does so stridently and unapologetically, unconditionally. He just says, the saints. The Siddiqun are the saints. It's as if he's a Jew who's translating the word Saddiqim, which is identical in its etymology. that the Siddiq is a saint for the Jewish believer. So Martin Lings is saying the Siddiq in Islam should also simply be regarded not as someone who just tells the truth or someone who is only sincere with all of the limitations that sincerity has, spiritually speaking, in the English language. Sanctity has no such limitation. So he just said, these are the saints, the ones who have attained the end of the path through their sincerity. Therefore, sincerity is, in its substance, tantamount to sanctity. Now, this sincerity went hand in hand, as I said just a moment ago, with disarming humility. I remember it must have been about 1987 or 88, when I went to a bookshop in Regent's Park near the mosque, and I asked for some books of Fridtjof Schuon, and I was shown to the various shelves that they had, which had one or two books by Schuon, and a few books by Lings. And the man who owned the bookshop came up to me and said, you know, you don't really need to read the books of Schuon anymore. I said, why is that? And he said, well, Lings, Abu Bakr Siraj ad-Din, is much greater than Schuon. And I politely nodded and thanked him for his advice, and I told Dr. Lings at the next opportunity that this is what happened, and he laughed, and he said, you should have said to him that Lings is nothing without Schuon. And this is when he had attained a certain amount of fame and renown in the Muslim world, and he had received prizes, and his book on the Prophet had sold tens of thousands, possibly now hundreds of thousands of copies. So in a certain sense, his fame, certainly in the Muslim world, was much greater than that of Fridtjof Schuon. But he simply said, Lings is nothing without Schuon. He also said to me around the same time that the Sheikh, Fridtjof Schuon, totally dominates my life. From moment to moment, he dominates my life. And I, as a 28-year-old person, in awe of the magnitude of this person's piety, bordering on, as I thought then, sanctity, I couldn't imagine the greatness, the plenitude of the sanctity of this man, Fridtjof Schuon, if Lings speaks like that about him. He used to say, I feel like a child when I'm in the presence of Fridtjof Schuon. That was the degree of his effacement before this master. And what we have, those of us who were not privileged to know Fridtjof Schuon himself well, but we knew him through the radiance of Martin Lings. We could guess at the greatness of this man through what we received from Martin Lings. So to praise Lings is to praise Schuon, as when you are praising a painter, praising a painting, you cannot but praise the painter thereof. And to speak of this sanctity of Martin Lings is to speak of the sanctifying power of the teachings of Fridtjof Schuon. It's not only to say that the painter was very great, it's to say that these apparently abstract, metaphysical, cosmological, philosophical, psychological, comparative religion teachings, apparently abstract, actually have been transformed into so many radiant jewels of sanctification, as we have witnessed in our own lifetimes through Martin Lings. So I'm sure that he would have wanted me at the beginning of this talk to stress the degree to which he owed everything to his master and how everything that he manifested in his books can be regarded as so many footnotes to those of his master. Now, he gave us some clues about what it means to be effaced before perfection. My cousin here, Rod, asked me the other day whether I was nervous about giving this talk, and I said, well, I'm very daunted because it's so difficult to speak about someone who was perfect. And he said to me, is anybody perfect? And I said, yes, by the grace of God, there are some who are perfect, and I have met one, and I've known one, and I've loved one, and I'm just painfully aware of the extent to which I fall short of his perfection. Therefore, I am daunted by the prospect of speaking about him. But he was perfection personified, Martin Lings. What is it that happens when you're confronted with this kind of perfection? He tells us in the chapter entitled Archetypes of Devotional Homage in his book Symbol and Archetype. All devotional homage, All hero worship worthy of the name proceeds subjectively. Note that carefully. Proceeds subjectively from within. From the perfection which exists in every soul, even though in the majority, it, the perfection, has been buried under the rubble of a fallen second nature. If the burial is too deep, the sense of values can be irremediably vitiated. But even a remote consciousness of the latent perfection is enough to serve as a basis for having ideals and to arouse in souls, at contact with actual perfection, the nostalgic recognition of a fulfillment, which is for them also a possibility and a goal to be reached. So when you are in contact with perfection in the form of a human being, something, Dr. Lings is telling us, something is awakened in ourselves. We can only recognize that perfection if it exists as a latent possibility within ourselves. The eye has to have something of luminosity in order to register light. There has to be a perfection within us to recognize a perfection without us. What he's saying is when you're in contact with actualized perfection, that can have an actualizing impact upon the soul of your own being. It can help you to bring to fruition the sanctity, the perfection that is waiting to be realized within you. And this is very close to something that Fritjof Schuon said in a marvelous definition of the deepest meaning of politeness, of what in Islam is called adab, good manners, politeness, courtesy. Far from being just horizontal, adab is vertical. Because, according to Schuon, when you are polite and courteous to your interlocutor, you are bearing witness to the potential sanctity of that person. And in relating courteously and kindly, politely to that person, you help that sanctity to come to fruition. This is what Martin Lings is telling us about devotional homage and about the need to be effaced before actualized perfection, if you are fortunate enough to come within the sphere of its radiance. This is reminding me actually of a hadith of transmitted on the authority, interestingly enough, transmitted on the authority of the great Abu Bakr, the first caliph of Islam, after the Prophet. He was seen to be looking, gazing at the face of Ali ibn Abi Talib. Imam Ali, the son-in-law of the Prophet, the cousin, and the Waliullah, the saint of God, the friend of God, par excellence. And people said to Abu Bakr, why are you looking at Ali like that? And he said, because I heard the Prophet say, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, that gazing on the face of Ali is a form of worship. An-nadharu ila wajhi Ali ibadah. In some versions it just says, gazing upon Ali is worship. Here we have the principle of darshan, what the Hindus call darshan. The spiritual blessings that you receive simply from the visual image in front of you of the saint. You're brought face to face with sanctified perfection. And that elicits within you a sanctifying effect. Therefore, it's a form of worship. That is what is meant in the deeper sense by saint worship, the worship of the saints, the adoration of the saints. You're not worshipping them apart from God. You're worshipping them insofar as they make God accessible to you and they help you to realize the divinity within yourself. There's no polytheism here. Houston Smith, one of the greatest, arguably the most authoritative of all teachers in the academic world of comparative religion in the 20th century, wrote in the In Memoriam section to Martin Lings' last book, A Return to the Spirit, he said, referring to one of Lings's book entitled A Sufi Saint of the 20th Century, he said, those of us who are contributing to this book, A Return to the Spirit, will in effect be doing our best to enter a tribute to a Sufi saint of the 21st century. That's how convinced he was that this in memoriam section, where many of us wrote tributes to Dr. Ling, including, of course, Houston Smith, the extent to which it was clear that this man was a living saint. In Islam, unlike in Christianity, a saint, a waliullah, a friend of God, is recognized as such in his or her lifetime. There's no canonization process as such. But very few people would doubt that were there such a canonization procedure, it would have begun immediately upon his death in 2005 at the age of 96. The number of people who expressed their belief that he was a saint is a kind of expression of the principle, vox populi, vox Dei. The voice of the people is the voice of God. Now, let's just say that the idea that came to me for this lecture was that sincerity can be understood as expressed on three levels. The level of the intellect, the level of the soul or character, and the level of the heart. On the level of the intellect, sincerity equals veracity, seeing things as they are. The great prophetic statement, the plea to God, the supplication, O Lord, show us things as they really are. So sincerity on the level of the intellect is veracity. Sincerity on the level of the soul or character is integrity, total virtue, impeccable virtue. And sincerity expressed on the level of the heart is sanctity, the integration within the deepest seat of consciousness of the principles understood by the mind and the virtues realized by the soul, all of which are so many reflections of the divine reality, the multifaceted reality of God, which is in its essence one. Likewise, sincerity or sidq or ikhlas in Arabic, literally purification leading to sincerity. Ikhlas means that, a process of purifying your soul of everything that is insincere. To reflect the oneness of God, those elements within the soul have to be integrated. And I believe that Dr. Ling's embodied those three dimensions of sincerity to perfection, and in his writings, one sees that expressed very clearly. So I'm going to take us through those three levels without elaborating too much, inshallah. You might ask, if Richard Schuon has said the last word about this and about that on the level of doctrine, as Martin Ling himself said in his book, The 11th Hour, he's put it very clearly that one has the sense in reading Schuon that about this and about that he has said the last word. He was under no doubts that all the major philosophical and religious questions had been solved by Schuon. If this is the case, you might ask, on the level of doctrine, veracity, what could the works of Martin Ling's add? And the answer is, of course, he applied the principles of Fritjof Schuon so perfectly to different domains. And I'm going to look at three domains within the level of doctrine: primordiality or tradition, essentiality as opposed to formalism, and universality as opposed to particularism. These are three regions, three themes within, one might say they sum up the most important aspects of Schuon's perennial philosophy: primordiality, essentiality, universality. And on the level of primordiality, or looking back, as it were, to man, woman, made in the image of God, this primordial aspect of Richard Schuon's writings have given rise to all sorts of confusions, misunderstandings about the meaning of being a traditionalist. And I personally prefer the word perennialist to traditionalist, because traditionalism implies a kind of nostalgic harking back to an irretrievable past. Whereas perennialism, as I said at the beginning, is all about the perennial values being eternally and therefore permanently accessible to us here and now. But many people think that the traditionalists, the perennialists, look back to this irretrievable past in a kind of hopeless nostalgia. And it's clear there's nothing Luddite about this group of writers. They're pragmatic when it comes to the modern world. They criticize very trenchantly the tendencies of modernism, relativism, nihilism, scientism, and all those things that are bound up with the specifically anti-traditional mindset that we're confronted with in the modern world. But there's nothing of a knee-jerk reaction against the modern world as such. It's against particular tendencies. And both Schuon and Ling stressed the need to be pragmatic in the modern world, and this also implied very strongly an apolitical stance. There's nothing political against the modern world here, contrary to what Mark Sedgwick said in a recent nonsensical book that he wrote. There's nothing political, far less fascistic, about this. It's a stance which is focused on the individual as the locus for reviving the values of tradition. And there's no political agenda, no political program attached to it. And one of the books that most brings home the positive dimension of this view of tradition is Martin Lings's book, The 11th Hour, in which he says clearly that we are living in a time just preceding the end. According to all the prophecies in different traditions, we're in the 11th hour. But he would stress that no one knows exactly how long this hour will last. It could be a year, it could be 10 years, it could be 100 years, it could be 1,000, it could be 10,000. The Dalai Lama recently said the end of this world will probably come in a few million years. So that is perfectly possible as well. But what we do know is that we're at the end of time, and that time may be prolonged, who knows. But what Ling said, which is so important, is that far from leading us to think of doom and gloom scenarios, the fact that we're in the 11th hour means that we're plunged into a moment of mercy. A hadith of the Prophet puts this very beautifully, that in the beginning of Islam, he who omits one-tenth of the law will be damned. But at the end of Islam, he who manages to accomplish one-tenth will be saved. Meaning that there's a compensatory mercy that comes to this world in proportion to the very difficulty of salvation, the very difficulty of attaining a path to salvation, because of what the Hindus call the dark age, the Kali Yuga in which we are, according to Hindu cosmology. But what Martin Lings extracted from this was, in fact, this beautiful statement that he said, we can make every single instant a moment of mercy. That's what we can do now. There is an abundance, a superabundance of available mercy to compensate for the very difficulty of our times. And that's really what matters for his, in terms of his perception of where we are in the scale of time. This is also manifest actually in an answer he gave to Mr. Hilali Nuruddin, a great surgeon, who I don't think was able to be with us today. But he told me that when it came to these ultra-modern techniques of surgery, Mr. Nuruddin is a world-famous back surgeon, and he treated Dr. Lings and Mrs. Lings, who unfortunately couldn't be with us tonight. And he asked him about the use of these ultra-modern techniques, and Dr. Lings said to him, there's nothing wrong with using these techniques. Use them for the good, for the benefit of your patients. All of these things are so many secondary causes, asbab in Arabic. They are secondary causes by means of which God is actually manifesting his quality as the healer. So have no reservations about it. Don't start thinking that I'm a traditionalist and I mustn't use these ultra-tradition techniques. It's all about not allowing yourself to be so dazzled by modern technology as to allow the truths of your tradition, the truths of metaphysics, to be eclipsed by the light that's generated by modern science. Use it. Don't allow it to abuse you. Don't allow yourself to be taken over by scientism, in other words. But use it with moderation and with reason and to the best, for the benefit of those people that you're coming into contact with. So, as I say, he no longer can be regarded as a traditionalist, half quarreling with the Book of Fate for having written me down so late. He's a perennialist. The truths of tradition, the truths of revelation are perennially accessible. Now, universality, still on the level of doctrine. What did Martin Lings add to the doctrine of universality? Very briefly.